crypto mining still definitely a thing. I have seen some research, not something that we've encountered ourselves, that threat actors might be trying to transition to different methods of making use of hijacked workloads, like proxy jacking, which is basically instead of abusing CPU, you abuse basically network capacity and you turn the victim workloads into something that you're just controlling and offering other threat actors access to, selling it off.
Welcome to another episode of Mandiant's Defenders Advantage podcast. I'm your host, Luke McNamara. Joining me today, we have Amitai Cohen, the Attack Vector Intel lead at Wiz. Amitai, great to have you here this evening, your time, and that we're recording this, my afternoon, my time, but great to have you here nonetheless.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So we're going to discuss cloud security, some of the research that you've been doing at Wiz, but to kick us off, I think probably for a lot of folks who are in the cloud security space, the name Wiz will not be an unusual one to them. I think that it's an increasingly well-known company. But for folks who aren't familiar with Wiz, sort of what is your mission as an organization? And then specifically as the Attack Vector Intel lead, what is your role there?
So Wiz is a cloud security company, as you mentioned. We try to cover anything we can in the cloud. And when we say cloud, we mainly mean infrastructure, AWS, GCP, and Azure environments. We do a bit of what's known as CSPM, which is the more classic coverage of misconfigurations in the cloud. That's like the starting point. We add on to that what's known as CNAPP, which is more focused on detecting vulnerabilities and detecting all sorts of issues that are more threat-related. And we also do something called CDR. These are all like Gartner terms, which is more like the equivalent of an EDR, basically detection in real time in the cloud.
And then specifically your role there, where do you kind of interface with those different kind of prongs of Wiz's focus?
So I lead a small team within the larger threat research organization at Wiz. The threat research org does a bunch of different stuff. A lot of the well-known stuff is finding vulnerabilities in cloud services, basically mistakes made by Azure, AWS, GCP. Proving, for example, cross-tenant lateral movement within the same service. Part of the work we do is more detection engineering for stuff that's related to the CDR. And we also do a lot of risk-focused threat research. And the company in general is very product-focused. Like everything at the end of the day feeds into the product somehow. And our work is no exception. So my team is basically in charge of collecting threat intelligence and translating that into better coverage for our customers.
Excellent. Well, I think we're going to touch on a lot of different pieces of what you just discussed right there, especially I think the risk component and translating, you know, threat intel into that to enable business decision making, as that's something that I think we've seen over the years increasingly. Is something that customers are asking for on the Mandiant side, beyond just sort of tactical implementation, remediation, advice, getting that understanding around risk. I want to start with, and maybe where we can begin the conversation is, you know, we have here at Google Cloud, the Threat Horizons report that gets published quarterly, and there's always some interesting data points in there and trends that specifically we're seeing with how cloud infrastructure is being targeted or exploited. I'm curious, what are some interesting trends that you've seen, that you've been tracking and thinking about this year? When you think about, you know, all the different, you know, threat vectors that you see of how cloud infrastructure is compromised, exploited, but what are some interesting trends that you've seen?
So I think, unfortunately, it tends to be a lot of the same year to year, which kind of shows that as an industry, we're probably not moving fast enough, or at least moving slower than attackers are. It's still a lot of misconfigurations being abused. It's still a lot of vulnerabilities that have CVEs and therefore should be properly handled, still being exploited on public-facing machines. It's still a lot of not good enough isolation within containerized environments. it feels like it's still a lot of the same. Like it's nothing especially sophisticated. Like certainly the vulnerabilities themselves might be, you know, getting more interesting, more creative year to year, but the attack surface isn't really changing that much. And you'd think it would be. You'd think we'd be getting better at this as an industry.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, from what you see quarter to quarter in that Threat Horizons report, and the stuff that our folks are seeing, you know, continued significant aspect of that is weaker no creds. Misconfiguration is certainly in there. And then in terms of the type of threat activity we see, a lot of it resulting in crypto mining activity. That continues to be, I think, a preponderance of when you kind of trace back and look at what the actual end goal of the attacker or threat actor is, it's crypto mining. And you see that again, quarter after quarter, certainly variations, and there's certainly niche areas where there's threat actors doing more creative things for different purposes. But that continues to make up a bulk, I think, of what we're seeing as well.
Yeah, for sure. Like crypto mining, I don't know if surprisingly, like I feel like Bitcoin is not going to be at the same peak that it was in the past and all the other crypto mining coins. But yeah, crypto mining is still definitely a thing. I have seen some research, not something that we've encountered ourselves, that threat actors might be trying to transition to different methods of making use of hijacked workloads, like proxy jacking, which is basically instead of abusing CPU, you abuse basically network capacity, and you turn the victim workloads into something that you're just controlling and offering other, you know, other threat actors access to, selling it off. But I think there have also been a few cases where crypto mining seems to have been sort of an afterthought, like maybe even something that was just used to throw researchers off, where there was evidence of crypto mining, there was evidence of a miner being being dropped in the environment, but the attacker sort of maybe just opportunistically, just because they could, they did move laterally into the environment and they did look for other things. So it's possible that crypto mining is sort of, I don't know, for some threat actors, it might just be a hobby. It might just be something they can do because they're already there. So why not? But of course, you also have the more sophisticated actors, just in terms of what they're capable of and what they're daring to do. Like what we saw with Lapsus last year, where they gained access to quite a few cloud environments. And it seems that their goal was mainly extortion. They knew their way around a cloud environment. And obviously you have a few Russian threat actors and Chinese threat actors that have been doing pretty well for themselves in the same area.
I'm curious, you know, one of the trends that kind of popped out in our MTrends report that we put out every year, drawn from the sort of IR insights of the year prior, this year, stolen creds was the third most common initial infection vector.
Yeah, and that's crazy.
Yeah,
it's like insane.
Exploits, phishing, and then stolen creds, and that data point is drawn from, you know, of course, all of our investigations, so not specific to cloud or on-prem infrastructure, but there does seem to have been, and this is something we also see in our underground forum and market research, a growing interest in obtaining initial access through creds, threat actors selling that, providing it to threat actors involved in multifaceted extortion, ransomware, etc. I'm curious to what extent you have seen stolen cred usage play a role in the incidents that you guys have investigated or that you've been witness to.
We've seen it a few times. It hasn't been, like, I can't say that it's been high enough numbers to actually be statistically significant, but it definitely does happen. I think most of our focus in that area has been sort of assuming that it is something that attackers are trying to do. It's possible, and that might just be the optimistic side in me speaking, but it's possible that we're just doing a good enough job of protecting our customers by making sure that their networks are well segmented enough to make sure that the impact is lessened, even if it does happen. So maybe it's happening and we're just not noticing it because there's no impact. Like that's one possible reason why we're not seeing it. Another is because we work really hard to make sure that we have detections in place for weak credentials. That doesn't necessarily cover stolen ones. Like if you have stolen creds that are very complex, then that's not going to help very much. But I like to think that A lot of our customers are properly using MFA. A lot of them, just because they're using cloud environments, they're using a lot of SaaS, they probably have MFA enabled in most cases. Like we see a lot of our customers using Okta, using those kind of solutions. So I'm guessing that protects them pretty well from stolen creds in a lot of cases, definitely not in all of them though. I think weak passwords, I think like weak passwords and empty passwords are also surprisingly common. And those are like lower hanging fruit.
Is that something that you've seen, in your opinion, kind of a greater improvement on, kind of, you know, writ large across the whole area of using MFA, being more mindful or even searching for leaked credentials that have been exposed, being more mindful of systems that don't have credentials, you know, implemented at all or default creds? That whole kind of category, have you seen a growth and maturity for organizations being much more cognizant around that in the last several years?
It's hard for me to say. I think in terms of the data that we have, I think we haven't been around long enough to be able to say anything very smart about like what the trend is there. Mm-hmm. I can say that I think, like just technologically speaking, I think it's a lot easier to safeguard against default creds and empty creds, especially for well-known applications, especially for operating systems. Catching stolen creds is harder. You have to rely on doing darknet research, like you do at Mandiant. You have to integrate that with being able to scan your own passwords, which is something that not all companies are necessarily willing to do or in a position to do. And in terms of MFA, it's actually hard to calculate, like other than doing surveys, like it's hard to actually get solid numbers on what percent, at least of cloud environments actually have MFA in use. Like there's a lot of places where you can make sure that it's in use. For example, having an IAM policy for access to a certain resource that requires MFA to allow access to the workload itself, right? So you can do stuff like that. You can have, but that's more like defense in depth. That's not necessarily evidence of you have a cloud customer and we know that they're using MFA and we know that every single user there has MFA. There's also the issue in cloud of long-lived credentials, which is something that AWS has been working to improve, but it still exists. Like you still have organizations using IAM users where long-lived credentials are more of an issue there. But unfortunately, I don't think I have very good data for any of this stuff. It's just stuff that we know exists. We know it's out there. We assume that these things are significant risks and we treat them appropriately in terms of risk management and making sure we have security controls for that for our customers.
So pivoting off of that and going back to something you said right now, but also at the beginning about risk. Maybe could you talk a little bit about how you view the threat research that you do at Wiz, how that translates into risk or how you help organizations think about translating that into risk. And I think this is something we talked a little about in the kind of pre-call about how I think still for a lot of organizations, even of higher levels of maturity, operationalizing intel can be very difficult. And I think this is one piece of that, the sort of translation into risk. So can you talk about that a little bit?
So it is a hard problem in general. And I think in cloud specifically, in terms of public threat intel, there's very little. There's a lot of stuff that's relevant for everything. For example, if you have someone scanning the entire internet for a vulnerability in, I don't know, like MSSQL, then that's going to have an impact both on-prem and in the cloud. But a lot of the stuff that's more cloud-specific, which mainly relates to post-compromise stuff, as in what attackers are doing once they gain a foothold in the environment, like if you exploit a DBMS vulnerability, like a vulnerability in MSSQL on a public-facing machine that has high privileges in the environment, like high identity privileges in the environment, that's going to look very different between on-prem and cloud. And there's very little threat intel available, at least publicly, about that sort of thing, which that's like a big challenge just for getting ground truth. because there's a lot of sort of more academic and theoretical research about what's possible, like what attackers might be able to do. But a lot of what we need threat intel for is for prioritization. So, for example, the easiest place to demonstrate that is in vulnerabilities, right? Because you have, like, I think like 200,000 CVEs on NVD, with many added every month. A lot of them aren't relevant to cloud environments just because of the technologies they affect. Like, you're not going to be, you shouldn't be concerned about vulnerabilities in like macOS in the cloud, just because that's so incredibly rare. Obviously for router vulnerabilities, that's just not going to appear in the cloud at all. But you have to do better than that, because that still leaves you with like at least like 50,000, 100,000 vulnerabilities that might be relevant, right? And there's only so much you can do with like CVSS parameters. Like at the end of the day, you still have to triage a ton of workloads that have vulnerabilities, probably a lot. There's a lot of junk CVEs out there. So it does help that you have things like EPSS, which is a sort of newer model for estimating the likelihood that a vulnerability is going to be exploited based on a bunch of different factors, but that's still somewhat theoretical. And there is a huge difference between an exploit being available for something, for example, a proof of concept on GitHub, as opposed to someone has intelligence that this is actually being used by a threat actor out there and is being used against organizations, and particularly against cloud organizations. So that's a very big challenge. What we try to do is build ourselves an internal database of known incidents where cloud environments were targeted, or cloud environments were targeted alongside on-prem environments, what the initial access vector was. For example, if it was exploiting a cloud misconfiguration, if it was exploiting an app misconfiguration, if it was stolen creds, if it was a weak password, if it was exploiting a vulnerability. And then we try to cross-reference that with everything we know about the technology, everything we know that might be relevant for giving more context. And then we try to focus on our efforts on making sure we have the best coverage possible for that specific technology, just because we recognize it as an attack surface that should be higher prioritized than others.
So that's very similar, I think, in terms of how we think about vulnerabilities. Certainly a heavier focus on, is this being actively exploited in the wild? Are there threat actors that are currently using that? And of course, even that itself, as you know, is a fast moving target. When you see, you know, maybe one threat actor exploiting a zero day in cloud or other sorts of technologies, and then sort of the rapid, you know, within days or weeks, depending on the difficulty of it, depending on if there's technical details or proof of concept code out there, you know, maybe a whole host of other threat actors exploiting it as well. And I think one thing that we've found to be somewhat useful in that prioritization is also thinking about who that threat actor is, what their mission is, what they're targeting, what particular verticals they go after, what particular regions they're active in. But I think that it's a very difficult and again, fast moving situation, with that focus still being around prioritization. How can you help the organization figure out if something beyond its CVS score, you know, should be higher or lower prioritization for them to fix and deal with? So I guess any thoughts around that?
Yeah, and I think like one thing that I found to be very frustrating, just when I'm reviewing past incidents, not necessarily stuff that happened to our customers, but just in general, is that oftentimes the initial access vector to a cloud environment will be a threat actor gaining access to, for example, an employee workstation, like getting access to a laptop, infecting it with malware, and then just impersonating that employee, stealing their token or just doing remote access through their laptop to the cloud environment. And at that point, it becomes, the only way to detect that is to be able to differentiate between that employee's normal behavior and what a threat actor is trying to do with their access. And if they're smart about it, then the chances of you detecting that are very, very low, especially if they're only accessing things that employee would be accessing anyway. And I think one of the challenges is around the fact that as a cloud security provider, our responsibility sort of ends at the edge of the cloud. But oftentimes incidents will involve everything. Like you'll have sort of a wide spectrum attack, against both the on-prem and the cloud environment, maybe even the employees' phones. You know, maybe there's social engineering involved. You know, maybe there's phishing. And that's why cases like the Lapsus case, and I think recently Microsoft published also about an Iranian threat actor that sort of did a destructive attack on a target, and they affected both the on-prem environment and the cloud environment. I think those cases are very interesting because they sort of show what nation-state actors and sophisticated actors in general are doing, which seems to be like they don't only attack the cloud.
So do you think that's sometimes a weakness in that, you know, maybe sometimes when people approach thinking about security in the cloud, they think about it too removed from all those other components of the network or the larger business environment? I think the point I was just going to make is obviously across the security landscape, people, different vendors and companies and security researchers are approaching things, you know, researching particular campaigns or topics or threat actors from a particular lens or particular focus. But, you know, given the point you just made that some of these campaigns that we're seeing and would expect to see more of as we see greater cloud adoption, they may begin on-prem, move to the cloud, vice versa. So thinking about it too separate from all these other components seems like that kind of sets yourself up to miss kind of massive components of the attack lifecycle.
Yes, correct. Although I will say that it does depend on the architecture of the specific cloud customer, because some companies are incredibly cloud native in the sense that they barely have any on-prem infrastructure. Other companies, the cloud is more of an afterthought, and other companies might be a merger between several different organizations, each with their own sort of approach to that. If you are a company that is mainly cloud-based, then I think it's easier to focus particularly on what's going on in the cloud, obviously.
Maybe we've touched on some of this already, but what are some under-discussed aspects of cloud security that you think don't get enough attention? We kind of began this conversation initially. You were talking about how a lot of the threat activity we see quarter after quarter, year over year, is very similar. And as a result, I think a lot of the discussion around cloud security kind of follows that. But are there certain components of this field that you think don't get enough attention, or there's not enough emphasis? People are discounting the importance of certain subtopics or areas of this space.
So I'll say that I think looking back a few years ago, I would have said that there are a lot of misconfigurations that people aren't paying enough attention to. I think the cloud security industry and the security research community has done a very good job at bringing those to the forefront and bringing a lot of attention to those issues, and also working with the cloud providers to sort of make those mistakes a lot more difficult to make. But there are areas where the industry, I think in general, hasn't been doing a good enough job at making things sort of organized. Like, for example, compare, let's say, CVEs, which are vulnerabilities that are enumerated, meaning that like you have a database you can reference. If you want to know if your organization is vulnerable to X, you can look up X in that database, cross-reference that with whatever detections you have for a given vulnerability, with whatever is installed in your environment, and you have a pretty good understanding of, do I need to care about this or not? Areas where we're not as mature, and I'm not saying CVE is especially mature, it's just, I think, old, and it has its perks and it has its issues. It's still a very problematic system, but it's a lot better than nothing. And I think there's a cost to running it and there's a cost to using it, but that's probably worth it. Compare that to, for example, technology inventories, which CVE treats as a CPE, which is basically like a way of enumerating something that is installed in your environment, but not everything has a CPE. And it's become especially more problematic with, let's say, like packages that you install from PyPI or from NPM or from GitHub. Like, there are so many. And that's an area where we're not doing as good a job of enumeration. Like, there's not necessarily a public database you can reference of every single piece of software in the world. And there probably never will be, because a company can write their own proprietary software and it's only going to be used within their own environment. And that probably doesn't have a CPE. So it becomes harder to keep track of those things. And then I think the thing that is currently the hardest to keep track of is misconfigurations, both in like in the cloud, like how you set up an S3 bucket or an EC2 instance, and in applications. Like there's no unique identifier for example, setting up a Jenkins instance with no authentication, which is something that people do. And it's very bad. It's probably even worse in some cases than a vulnerability. For example, you have cases where people leave Jupyter notebooks publicly exposed and allowing access without authentication. That is equivalent and probably worse than an RCE vulnerability on the machine that is running that Jupyter notebook. And none of these things have unique identifiers, which means that if you are running security for a company, it's very difficult to like talk about these things. You can't look online and say, what do I need to be concerned about today? And how do I check if I'm affected by it? As opposed to CVEs where that's at least possible.
Right. That's the organizational piece you were talking about where you have the number, you can look that up. It's easily searchable. And you at least have something to compare it to directly.
Yeah. And even like in terms of communication, like you can say, you know, I'm not saying this is what people do, but like a CISO can meet up with another CISO at a bar and say, oh, are you affected by CVE so-and-so? And the other person knows exactly what they're talking about. And if they don't, they can look it up on Google and they know what it is. And misconfigurations aren't like that. And they can often be just as bad.
So moving this to kind of where you see that we are headed and thinking about, you know, some of the trends that you're watching, you know, now in the second half of this year, and even going into 2024, what are some trends you think people should be looking for? What are some things that you're thinking about as you're doing threat research at Wiz with respect to cloud security?
So this might be too obvious of an answer, but I'm going to say AI. Specifically, when I say that, and I've noticed that it's very difficult to talk about AI and security because it means different things to different people. A lot of people's first association when saying those two words together is like employees leaking data to ChatGPT. Sometimes it's going to be threat actors using ChatGPT to generate like authentic phishing emails at scale. Our focus when we talk about AI is companies incorporating AI models in their products and the fact that they are probably not prioritizing security highly enough when they're doing so, meaning that they're going to make a lot of the same mistakes that have been made every time a new technology is widely adopted very, very fast. A lot of the same issues that we've detected in cloud services in terms of improper tenant isolation, in terms of not enough defense in depth, are probably going to be plaguing these types of services as well. And they're even harder to understand because oftentimes they're not deterministic and they're treated as sort of black boxes and people are hooking them up to things that they shouldn't necessarily be hooking them up into. And we also see a lot of people relying on security boundaries, which are untested and unproven. For example, all sorts of guardrails on the behavior of, let's say, an LLM model, but those are often broken. Like there's a lot of research and a lot of proof that every time you set up a guardrail, it's just a matter of time until someone figures out a way to do a prompt injection and bypass it. And people are relying on this stuff as security boundary, which I think is a mistake. And I'm sure we're going to be seeing a lot of companies make those mistakes as their products become enterprise ready or supposedly enterprise ready. So I think that's a challenge we're going to have to be dealing with both, especially in the cloud, because AI sort of, at least the way that companies are using it nowadays and the way that it's capable of being scaled is a cloud technology. Like it's a very cloud native technology.
Yeah, that is something we have started putting a lot of thought towards with our SAFE framework, secure AI framework, is how organizations can think about securely implementing AI. Mm-hmm. But yes, I think it's something that organizations certainly have to give some conscious thought towards how they're going to do that. Any other kind of areas of threat that you see, you know, that maybe we're seeing somewhat, maybe in kind of a minimal aspect today, but you think could grow or expand categories of threat and impacting cloud?
So there are some things that have so far been mainly theoretical, or at least not really mentioned that much in public reporting. It's possible that there's private reporting I'm unaware of. It's possible that there have been cases that haven't made it to the public. For example, other implementations of ransomware that aren't based on malware. For example, it's been shown that you can apply the concepts of ransomware to, for example, a bucket. And if you are sitting in an organization long enough and you're dwelling for a long enough time, it's possible that you can take control of the backup system and reach the same impact as installing ransomware in an on-prem environment, in a cloud environment, just by having the right permissions. This has so far been called sort of S3 ransomware, but maybe that's not the most accurate term for it because there's no where involved. It's more of a ransom op, I guess. So that's not necessarily something I'm saying will happen. It's more something I'm saying it'll be interesting to see if it does, because so far it's been pretty theoretical as far as I know. I think it'll be interesting to see also if, other than cryptojacking and proxyjacking, if threat actors think about other creative ways to make use of hijacked resources. I'm guessing that's not the only two things you can do with a hijacked resource. You can probably do a lot more. Trying to think if there's anything else.
Well, even just going back to that ransom component, I think the one thing you can say we have seen historically with what we refer to internally as multifaceted extortion is that it will expand, right? It went from just being pure play ransomware to threat actors realizing, oh, well, if I'm moving laterally through a victim environment, I come across some interesting files and emails. This is something that could extort the company over threatening to release this publicly. And you've seen some threat actors that have shifted to just doing that or doing that as a way to expand the leverage that they're putting on the organization. So I think there's clearly a history of threat actors in that space looking at creative ways that they can expand their extortion operations. I'm curious, when you think about, and we've kind of touched on this a couple times now, here's something that's theoretical. What would be the drivers that would make that jump from kind of the theoretical side of the equation to this is something we're going to actually start seeing threat actors adopt in a sizable way? Because you're right, there's a lot of things that are theoretical that we never really see that happen. Threat actors tend to gravitate towards things that are simple, enabling them to accomplish the mission, whatever it is. Yeah. So what's kind of like, I guess, the mental model or rubric you use when you see something like that, where this is theoretically possible, and I can understand why certain categories of threat actors would do this, what would be some things that you would look for as drivers of pushing that over the line?
So I guess it really depends on how cloud customers would be using the cloud. There are many, many, many services. A lot of them are complex. A lot of them are hard to set up. A lot of them have misconfigurations that are easy to make. And it's possible that certain combinations of services might have inherent weaknesses that sort of like the opposite of bigger than the sum of its parts, like two services that on their own aren't very interesting to threat actors, but perhaps together they can do a lot of damage. Cloud environments also have all sorts of services like, for example, AWS Glue, where you're basically mishmashing different components together and creating all sorts of workflows. And that's an area, I think, where threat actors might be able to do some damage if they gain access to that, sort of do like a, I guess, like an internal supply chain within an organization. And I think another area, which has been talked about a lot recently, and we actually recently put out a bit of research about that, is the connection between services like GitHub and GitLab and cloud environments, because often organizations will have connections between these things where you have code being deployed in both directions and GitHub actions making changes to cloud environments and vice versa. And that is another area where people tend to make mistakes in terms of setting it up securely. It's two very different environments, and you have to have people who are knowledgeable about both in order to make sure that you're not making mistakes. And that's an area where most of the exploitation has been theoretical. It's mostly been security researchers saying, hey, look at this thing we did, and we proved that we could do this to a bunch of organizations. I'm not familiar with cases where it's been proven that a threat actor did this sort of thing. So that's another area where it remains to be seen if this is interesting enough and attractive enough for threat actors to gain access to like a CI/CD system as an initial access vector to an environment.
Well, certainly a lot there, I think, in terms of food for thought and some things to kind of look, be on the lookout for if we do see that adoption in new techniques by adversaries. Amitai, this has been great. For folks that want to stay abreast of all the research that you guys are doing at Wiz, where is best for them to check that out?
So we have our blog feed at wiz.io. You can also check out our website that we're in, which we organize cloud vulnerabilities, called cloudvulndb.org. You can also check out our monthly newsletter, where we basically put out like highlights from our own threat research that we offer to customers, basically saying like, here are the vulnerabilities and types of attacks that we dealt with in the past month that we worked hard to make sure that our customers are protected from. And here are our insights about them and things that we feel that cloud customers should be paying attention to. We also have a podcast called Crying Out Cloud, where we talk about similar things. And I think that's pretty much it.
Yes, I was going to mention, you're the host of that podcast, correct?
Yes, I'm a co-host, along with my co-host, Eden.
Fantastic. We'll include the link in the show notes. So people, please go check that out if you are interested in hearing more about cloud security. Amitai, this has been great. Thank you so much for your time, and have a great rest of the day.
Thank you very much.